In our study tonight, let's turn to Revelation chapter 20. We began our study in chapter 20 the last time. And we want to review a little bit, say a few things about the passage, and then go on with our study of it. In chapter 20, he says, "I saw an angel coming down out of heaven." I want to just make some comparisons with you right quick. I want you, for example, to notice the difference between "I saw an angel coming down out of heaven," and then in Revelation chapter 9, "The fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star from heaven fallen upon the earth. And there was given unto him the key of the pit of the abyss." So in chapter 9, when we have someone, something, taking given to him the key of the pit of the abyss, well, over here in chapter 20 and verse 1, we also see a key of the abyss and the great chain. But the one who has that in chapter 20 and verse 1 is an angel coming down out of heaven. Not an angel fallen out of heaven, but an angel coming down out of heaven. Whereas in chapter 9, it is, "I saw a star from heaven fallen." Now, usually when something falls, it's not supposed to fall. This is something that fell that didn't expect to fall. "I saw a star from heaven fallen unto the earth, and there was given to him the key of the pit of the abyss, and he opened the pit of the abyss." In other words, he let these things out. Therefore, I am more inclined to think that the star in chapter 9 and verse 1 is a being of evil, and possibly Satan himself. So here he falls upon the earth. There's given him the key of the pit of the abyss. Whereas over in chapter 20 and verse 1, it is an angel who has come down out of heaven. He has the key of the abyss and a great chain in his hand. Several times in the New Testament, that word abyss is used. We referred to that word the last time in our lesson. So I wanted to refer to it again and just show you the places where it is used. In Revelation, look at chapter 11 and verse 7. Now this is in the chapter where he's dealing with two witnesses, two faithful witnesses. And verse 7 says, "And when they shall have finished their testimony, the beast that cometh up out of the abyss shall make war with them and overcome them and kill them." Now, here is the abyss as something that the beast is coming up out of. And back in chapter 9, it is hellish influences of all sorts coming up out of the abyss, let out of the abyss by this star that had fallen with the key to the abyss. And so hellish influences come up out of that pit or that abyss. And here in 11:7, it is the same idea. And then look in chapter 17. Chapter 17 and verse 8. "The beast which thou sawest was and is not, and is about to come up out of the abyss." Now, in these three references that we've looked at here, in 9, 1 and 2, in 11, 7, and here in 17, 8, we see things coming out of the abyss. Now, does everybody see that? I mean, there's some things in Revelation may be a little hard to understand, but we can see whether it's coming or going, can't we? All right, in all three of these passages, we have things coming up, either the hellish influences, evil of all kinds in chapter 9, the beast in chapter 11 and chapter 17. Now, another reference that we need to kind of bring into this, put it together, is in Luke 8 and verse 31, where Jesus encountered the Gerasene demoniacs possessed with demons. That's what a demoniac is. They begged Jesus not to command them to depart into the abyss. So just hold on to that for a moment. These demoniacs begged Jesus not to command them to depart into the abyss. In Matthew's account of that same story, the demons asked Jesus, Are you come to torment us before the time? Which implies there was a time that they could expect to be tormented. They were expecting to be tormented at some point. Are you come hither to torment us before the time? Now, since their fear of the torment and their fear of the abyss seems to have been united together, then I'm assuming that the abyss, in their case, would have been a place of torment. Would you think that would make sense? They're dreading the abyss. They're dreading the torment. And therefore, I think it is logical to assume that these things can be associated together. Now, another interesting passage where this is used is in Romans. So turn there for a moment. This one is a very interesting one. Romans 10. Now, so far, I would say that every reference we have looked at has been a reference that has to do either with the hellish influences that come from the abyss, or it is a place of torment for the demons, and so on. But in chapter 10 of the book of Romans, and verse 7, we just plunge right into the middle of what's actually a quotation. Or who shall descend into the abyss, that is, to bring Christ up from the dead? Now, if you take that verse, referring to who's going to ascend, to descend into the abyss to bring Christ up out of the dead, would that not imply that the abyss is a place where the dead are and where even Christ was? You know, he was in Hades, but his soul was not left in Hades. I believe that here in Romans 10 and verse 7, we have probably the clearest parallel between the use of the abyss in reference to Hades, the realm of the dead, of any of the references having to do with the abyss. Now, the passage that is being quoted here is from Moses, and he begins back in verse 5, quoting from Moses. And the passage that he's quoting is in Deuteronomy 30. And in the context of Deuteronomy 30 in verse 14, what Moses was telling the people at that time. And remember, that was the time that they were over on the plains of Moab, across the Jordan from Jericho, waiting the time when they would cross the Jordan and begin their conquest of the land. Moses was preaching to them, and he was trying to prepare them to go across and to be faithful and so on. So that's what he was trying to do. So when he had revealed the information found in the book of Deuteronomy to them, see, chapter 30 is almost at the end of Deuteronomy. Then his basic point he's making is, look, God has revealed this information and he's put it right out here for you. So you don't have to say, oh, who's going to go to heaven and get it for us? Well, nobody has to go to heaven to get it for you. It's been brought right down here where you are. It's been given to you. It is accessible to you. But who's now in the book of Deuteronomy in the Old Testament, he uses the idea, who's going to go across the sea? Or possibly who's going to go down into the sea? And that word abyss in the Old Testament, in the Septuagint translation, is used to refer to the depth of the sea as well. So that the point Moses is making is that this word is near you. It is accessible to you. Here it is. Now, here in Romans 10, when Paul is quoting this, the point he's making, is that the gospel of Jesus Christ has also been made accessible to us. We don't have to do anything impossible to have it or to enjoy it. So, in connection with that, he uses somewhat the same language and defines it and comments on it. So, when he uses the abyss in this passage, he uses it to make the point that no one has to go get Jesus out of heaven. No one has to go down into the abyss. That is to bring him up from the dead. The word has been put out where we can have it. It is fully accessible to us. Now, that's the context. But the reference here to the abyss seems to be the clearest one in which it is used merely as an equivalent for Hades. All right, now another passage that I want us to look at as we just put together all the information that we can about this in 2 Peter chapter 2. Look in 2 Peter chapter 2. And in this chapter where Peter is warning about false prophets, in verse 4, "For if God spared not angels when they sinned, but cast them down to hell." Now, at that point, if you look in your footnote, or possibly even in your text itself, depending on what translation you have, you would find that in the original here, it is not Gehenna, and it is not Hades, but it is the word Tartarus, a word in Greek mythology referring to the underworld. Well, obviously, Peter is not using it in the sense of Greek mythology, but he is using the word to refer to angels. When they sinned, God cast them down to this place, committed them to pits of darkness to be reserved unto judgment. Now, look at the parallel, because Jude is roughly parallel to 2 Peter. Turn over and look at the book of Jude, and it's interesting to me to notice this verse in the book of Jude and verse 6. And kind of keep in mind, I have my Bible where I can look easily at 2 Peter 2:4 and Jude verse 6. And where Peter writes, "For if God spared not angels when they sinned, but cast them down to Tartarus and committed them to pits of darkness to be reserved unto judgment," verse 6 of Jude, "and angels that kept not their own principality, but left their proper habitation, he hath kept in everlasting bonds under darkness, under the judgment of the great day." Now, when you read verse 6 in Jude, and he says, "everlasting bonds," does that sound like they're going to kind of be able to get out on furlough now and then go back? Doesn't sound like it to me. And yet, we've seen several instances of abyss being used in the sense of a place from which evil forces come forth. Have we not? Is that right? This is one of the reasons why I am inclined to think that we may not be right in just assuming that everywhere we find that word abyss, that it is equivalent to torment in Hades. I'm just not sure about that. And one of the reasons why I wanted to give you this little rundown is to show you the things that make me a little bit hesitant about that. Now, you take here in chapter 20, where the dragon, the old serpent, the devil, Satan, bound for 1,000 years, cast him into the abyss. All right, if this is the same abyss as the Tartarus of 2 Peter 2, and which Jude refers to in verse 6, what about the everlasting bonds? And yet, what's going to happen to Satan at the end of this 1,000 years? He's going to be loosed for a little season. See that? And so there are just several questions that I have about that want me to just sort of keep my powder dry and just keep thinking about that for a while. I don't have any problem if it were proven to be torment in Hades, and that across the board that's what it is. I wouldn't have any problem with that. But I'm just not fully convinced that that is the case. So I think that the abyss may be used in somewhat different senses. Sometimes, like in Romans 10, it seems to be clear it is being used to refer to Hades there. But I think that sometimes it is being used to signify the idea of a place of confinement. And it appears to me that that's probably the thing that I'd rather stick with there in chapter 20, where we're looking at the devil, who's going to be cast down into this abyss, and it's going to be sealed over him, and he's going to be there. And then 1,000 years, for 1,000 years, and then after this, he must be loosed for a little time. Now, we talked about that the other time. I wanted to go back over that a little bit, just to kind of review, you know, what we had said, and also to bring in some more passages to look at that. So we will just continue to look at that, but clearly we know this, that the devil is here confined. He is confined and he is limited. Now, I think the evidence is clear that he has continued with some of his activity, because Peter states in 1 Peter 5 and verse 8, "Be sober, be watchful, your adversary the devil as a roaring lion walketh about seeking whom he may devour." Now then, in verses 4 through 6, let's notice that one. And we kind of looked at that, but we need to look closely at it. And I told you last time about the theory of premillennialism. One of the most prominent theories and doctrines and theologies that's been ever in the church. It dates from the early centuries of the church. And a lot of it was based on Jewish speculation. On Jewish speculation. And those that were into it found the book of Revelation a kind of a ground, a romping ground that they could get in and they could pull some things and make it, you know, support what they were trying to say. But, of course, the book of Revelation was not written for that purpose. But premillennialism is basically the idea that Jesus is going to have a literal 1,000 years reign upon the earth, that he's going to reign upon the throne of David in Jerusalem, and that he's going to come back to the earth before that 1,000 years reign is, so that the coming of Jesus is premillennial. So the whole name of the doctrine, premillennialism, has to do with the coming of Jesus in connection with his kingdom. So that would be his kingdom does not exist now. See, he's going to come back whenever. When he does come back, there will be the thing that is called the rapture. And the idea of the rapture, that word is used in the sense of snatching something away. Now, we think of rapture as being carried away with humor, you know, something like, well, I'm just enraptured. But actually, the idea of carrying away, being carried away, is very much part of the word. And when we talk about a bird of prey, we call that a raptor. A raptor. So I think you need to know, when you're thinking about premillennialism, why in the world do they use rapture? Well, rapture means to be snatched away. And so what they teach is that when the rapture occurs, Jesus is going to approach the earth again. At that point, he won't come all the way down, but he will approach the earth. And the living saints are going to be caught away like that. And you can read both doctrinal works and fictionalized works, such as the one that Jerry Jenkins and Tim LaHaye have written in the Left Behind series. They even have some video, some movies based on that. And they'll have people on the airplane just suddenly, they're just gone. People in the cars just driving down the street, they're just gone. The righteous just snatched away, and the dead righteous raised right up from right from paradise, right up to meet the Lord, and then they're going to be with him there for 7 years, based on an interpretation of one of the 70 weeks that's in Daniel 9. And during that 7 years, there's going to be tribulation on earth such as there has never been before. And the Antichrist will show up. And he will make all sorts of overtures to the Jews. But the Jews will gradually see through it. And then they will begin to turn. And all of the Jews will ultimately be converted. And there will be this tremendous battle. And right in the middle of this tremendous battle, Jesus is then going to come all the way back down to earth. He's going to come down on the Mount of Olives. And he will establish his throne of David and so on in Jerusalem, and will reign there for 1,000 years. And then at the end of that time, there will be another kind of a showdown type thing, and then it will all be over. Now that's premillennialism. So So I review and remind you of what it is. Now, as you think about that doctrine, let me show you some things that if you look in verses 1 through 10 of this chapter, they are not even mentioned. Number one, the second coming of Christ. So, you know, if you you may not be able to remember all of these, but if you could, just look for it. Where is the second coming of Christ mentioned? Where is a bodily resurrection mentioned? Where is the reign of Christ on earth mentioned? The literal throne of David? Jerusalem or Palestine? The conversion, the wholesale conversion of the Jews and the church on earth? Nothing about any of that here. The picture that we see here is of the dead who have been beheaded for the testimony of Jesus. That's one. And the other, and such as worship not the beast, neither his image, and receive not the mark upon their forehead and upon their hand, and they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. I want to remind you, don't forget to get the message out of the book. Don't get so fogged in by the things that we wonder about and the questions that maybe we don't know, the questions that have no answer given or something. Don't let that make you miss the point that the dead saints were not defeated. Instead, they lived and reigned with Christ during this period symbolized by the 1,000 years. And I believe that this 1,000 years symbolizes the time from the destruction of the beast, the bringing to an end of the persecution there in the days of the Roman Empire and so on, until the end comes. One of the things that makes me believe that when we get to chapter 20, we're looking at things that no more just a judgment on the way to the final judgment. But I believe the evidence is that here we're going to be seeing the final judgment. One of the things that makes me think that is that so far as we've gone along, we've seen the beast. Well, first we saw Babylon go down. Then we saw the earth beast go down. And then we saw the false prophet go down. And what was done for them, with them? Lake of fire. It's over. What about the devil? Was he fully done for? Was he cast into the lake of fire up until now? No. But we're going to see even him cast into the lake of fire, so that we will come to that finality for him that we've already seen for Babylon and the beast and the false prophet. And therefore, I am inclined to believe that the language here in the last part of chapter 20 requires us to consider that it is the final judgment. So, in this passage here, we see the souls of them that have been beheaded and those who remain faithful to the Lord and so on. The rest of the dead live not until the 1,000 years should be finished. This is the first resurrection. All right, now, as you think about the rest of the dead there, when we use other passages like Luke 16, does Luke 16 and the story of Lazarus and the rich man, does that make us think that the rich man was absolutely unconscious? He had no consciousness? No, he had consciousness. So in what sense could we say that the rest of the dead live not? Well, there are two things I have to suggest about that for you to think about. One is that the situation of the unrighteous dead could not be in any way considered living, even though they existed. You wouldn't call it life. And so that will continue until the final resurrection. Well, that doesn't mean that after that, then they're going to be set free or something. But that will be something that will bring them back. They will be raised. All the dead will be raised at the last day. I think that Jesus settled that beyond dispute in John 5, 28 and 29. When he said, "Marvel not at this, the hour cometh when all that are in the tomb shall hear his voice and shall come forth. They that have done good under the resurrection of life. They that have done evil under the resurrection of condemnation. Now that's one possibility. Here's another possibility. That the idea of the rest of the dead live not until the 1,000 years should be finished. This has to do with those who are allied with the forces of wickedness. And it is as if at this point their cause has just been killed. And they have been suppressed. The devil himself in confinement. But is there going to be any revival at all of their cause after the 1,000 years? What's the devil? What's going to happen? He's going to be loosed for a little season. And so those are the two views that I think are the best to consider. And I think I lean toward that latter one. That when it's talking about the rest of the dead here, it is talking about the wicked. At this point, it looks like their cause has been so completely defeated. There is absolutely nothing that they're going to be able to look to and have any cheer at all. But there's going to be one more. And that is that after the 1,000 years, then the devil will be loosed for a little season. And so that may be what it is. Buford, you have any thoughts on that? I know Buford has really studied a lot and helped me a lot in this. And so I just thought I'd ask if you have any thoughts to share on that. Right. Right. I think that's right. Not only is he overcome, but look at the blessed state of these dead saints. And again, it is a book of comfort. We must not forget, it is a book of comfort. All right, anyone else have a comment or a point that you want to make? I don't have a copyright on this. Mike, do you have any thoughts you'd like to offer? That's right. They're variations. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I believe Jeremiah 22, where it's talking about, and I won't go into that much, but I do want to just briefly refer to it. Jeremiah 22, verse 30. Thus saith the Lord, write ye this man, and it's Coniah or Jeconiah. Write ye this man childless, a man that shall not prosper in his days, for no more shall a man of his seed prosper sitting upon the throne of David and ruling in Judah. That's the one that you were thinking about. And that's an excellent one. Okay, notice then the comment made here in verse 6, Revelation 20 and verse 6. Blessed and holy is he that hath part in the first resurrection. Over these the second death hath no power. Now, the second death is going to be defined as eternal hell, the lake that burns with fire and brimstone. The first resurrection is not specifically defined, but it is very carefully illustrated here, which is the idea that here someone dies and finds himself living and reigning with Christ. That's the first resurrection. That he dies, but he finds that he's more alive than he ever was. So here's the first resurrection. Over that one, the second death will have no power. So it's interesting that you have a first resurrection and a second death, but there is no definition. There is no specific reference to the second resurrection here and the first death. So I think it's good not to just go too much into trying to work all that out. If I had to say what is the first death here, I would say it is a death wherein one dies and finds himself lost. So if I had to try to define what the first death would be in contrast to the second death, that would be about the best I could guess, but that's what it would be. And the second resurrection, even though that's not mentioned specifically, it would have to be that resurrection that awaits. That's the only other resurrection there is. And it will be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. But when the righteous are raised, according to Jesus in John 5, what will they be raised unto? What will the righteous be raised unto at that last resurrection? Life. Life eternal. Everlasting life. Yes. Yeah. If you've got that, do you have it there? Can you remember what it is? Yeah. Right. And I knew about that quotation. In fact, I had done a little thinking and I couldn't recall it. So I'm glad you did. One birth, two deaths. Two births, one death. That Martin Luther had written that down in the margin of his Bible. Pretty good, isn't it? That's good. Okay. Now then, let's look in verse 7. And when the 1,000 years are finished, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison and shall come forth to deceive the nations. Now, that was the exact point made in connection with his confinement back up in verse 3, that he should deceive the nations no more. So that's kind of reversed or undone here in verse 8. He shall come forth to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to the war, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea. Now, here again, you get into what many religious people have just turned into their own mythology. And Gog and Magog is a part of that. But to understand about Gog and Magog, what we have to do is to go back to the Old Testament, where they are first used. And it is in the book of Ezekiel. In the book of Ezekiel. And if you look in the book of Ezekiel 38, chapters 38 and 39, it's so interesting. So interesting when you look at it in context. And the message is so powerful and so clear when you look at it in context. And while you're turning to Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39, let me remind you that starting back in Ezekiel 35, God is saying, Edom, the perpetual enemy of Israel, has no future. In 36, in contrast, he says, Israel is going to have a future. But he points out that Israel is very disheartened, finds it hard to believe that there could ever be life for them again. So in 37, what's the story he has there? The Valley of the Dry Bones. To make the point that if God can raise these totally dead, dry bones from the dead, if he can raise them up, what can he do to Israel? He can restore them also. Now, when he does that, look in chapter 38, because in verse 16, as he tells about when this is going to be, and thou shalt come up against my people Israel as a cloud to cover the land, Ezekiel 38, 16, thou shalt come up against my people Israel as a cloud to cover the land. It shall come to pass when? In the latter days. Now that expression is used in the prophets to refer to the Messianic age. Not some time back in the Old Testament, but in the Messianic age. And this is one of the major, major passages in the prophets, of which there are so many, pointing to the fact that when God would establish the kingdom of the Messiah, there would be a terrific effort on the part of the devil and on the part of the nations to stop that and to destroy it. But God would overcome. And that's the message that is here in this story about Gog. In verse 2, by the way, of chapter 38, God says, Son of man, set your face toward Gog of the land of Magog. So listen, there's not a lot to be known about that. And there, you don't need to know a lot about it. It's a symbol. What it is a symbol of is the unregenerated people, the unsaved people of the earth, how they will turn and strive against the Lord to keep the Lord from accomplishing His purpose. It's exactly the same point in the second Psalm. Why do the heathen rage? Well, it's Gog of the land of Magog. If you look up the people that are mentioned here, Meshech and Tubal and Cush and Put and those names such as that, you will find that none of them is of Shem. They are of Ham and Japheth. And I think that the point is that it is through Shem that Abraham came. It is through Shem that the Messiah came. And so I think that the reason why the names are being used of Ham and Japheth is to suggest the idea these are the people who were not involved with God and His plan and so on. These were the pagan people. These were the unregenerated people. So, at this time when the devil is going to be loosed for a little season, guess who it's going to be that flocked to his banner? Who's going to flock to his banner? It's going to be the unregenerated. It's going to be the unsaved. It's going to be the same people that have rebelled against him all along. Oh, things look bad here. Look bad, sure enough. Number of whom is as the sand of the sea, back in Revelation 20. And verse 9, and they went up over the breadth of the earth and compassed the camp of the saints about. We're surrounded. We're surrounded. And the beloved city, and then what? Fire came down out of heaven and devoured them. Boy, what a battle that was. When God got ready for it to stop, He just stopped it. Defeated them. And the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where are also the beast and the false prophet. Now, they were dealt with earlier. Now, the devil himself is dealt with. And they shall be tormented day and night forever and ever. So, this language, as well as the language of the remaining paragraph, verses 11 through 15, suggests to me strongly the idea of that last judgment when the devil will be fully and finally defeated. And I saw a great white throne and him that sat upon it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. And as you're reading along there, you think about the passages such as 2 Peter 3. About the heavens and the elements and the heavens and the earth and all of that being dissolved. Elements melting with fervent heat. He says, I saw the dead, the great and the small, standing before the throne. The great and the small. And you know what? Everything in between. The great and the small. The most powerful men that ever lived upon the face of the earth. The greatest kings, the greatest rulers. As well as the most humble person who never even made it into the history books. And that'll be most of us. Most of us will never make it into the history books. But all of the dead, the great and the small, standing before the throne. And books were opened. And another book was opened, which is the book of life. Oh boy, have we got our work cut out for us here. The books were opened. So what books were these? All right. The proper answer is it doesn't say. The one book that is defined as what? The book of life. And the thing that is said about the book of life, the dead were judged out of the things which were written in the books. These books are records according to their works. And so the dead are judged out of the things written in the books. The records. And like Buford said, you know, when death comes, our record is completed. There won't be any revising. You know, when I write, I like to revise. But when your life is written and the chapter is closed and the book is closed, there's no further revision. That's the way it's going to stand. You can't go back and delete a chapter. You can't move a paragraph around. And so that's a thing to understand and realize. It's a thing to be sober about. Peter writes, but the end of all things is at hand. Be ye therefore of sound mind and be sober unto prayer. All right, our time is almost up, and I don't want to rush over the last part of this. So there are a few more verses there I want us to give particular attention to. So let's just plan. We'll take up with verses 11 through 15, have a few more comments about that next time, and then we will go on into chapter 21.